like true crime without all the nonsense, just want the facts and a theory of what happened from someone that's been on the planet for a while? If so, be sure to check out my podcast, The Dark Side with Breaker O'Day, a bi-weekly podcast that's semi-professional and is too lazy to edit. Hope to see you on The Darker Side.
True crime is one of the biggest genres in podcasting right now, and if you're a fan, chances are that you think you've heard of every single case that's out there. Well, if you're looking for a new podcast to binge, try Suspiria, a true crime podcast.
Every week, we cover interesting, outrageous, and unbelievable crimes that happen all over Latin America or involving Latin people, all through the voices of me, Carol,
and me, Stephanie. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, CastBox, Overcast, and many other streaming services. So check us out.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
What's going on with your bad self?
Oh, you know, same.
That's it?
Okay, that's good. It. How right, about you? Good. You? Good?
Oh, nothing. It's still 500 degrees here in Missouri,
yeah.
And it is almost fall and almost October.
Oh, yep.
That's so dumb. I'm so angry. I'm very angry about it.
I know.
Anyway.
But I've got some shout outs for people who have were kind enough to leave some reviews.
Let's hear it.
Andy.
Andy.
All the way from London sent us a nice little review.
Andy from London?
Andy from London.
Oh, that's so cute.
The great podcast Critical Onions left the review, as did Beyond the Rainbow. Thank you guys. Beyond we appreciate it. Rainbow. We need to return the favor. Just haven't gotten around to it. That's kind of my life.
It is kind of old.
W. Warlick, Liz Lur, Go Get in Grits. Grizz.
Go
Get him, Grizz, I think is how you say it.
Okay.
I can't read my handwriting. Go figure.
That's a shocker.
I know. Dog's Dad 25. Who?
Dog's Dad. We know him.
We know him. Hey, I know you.
Hey, I know you.
And Bonin Shoes.
You are so good with... You are multiple lingual.
I am.
You're a linguist. You're
and
so really
also,
good.
Also, big shout out to our new Patreon, Megan. Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Megan.
And also, I forgot to say the other day, and a big shout out to Justin Rimmel.
Mr. Super Cute.
Smoking hot.
Eyes.
No,
smoldering
he's,
eyes.
He's a great... guy.
No, he
love
is.
Him.
So
if
nice.
You haven't listened to his podcast, go ahead and do it.
If you like history, but history and crime, that's awesome.
Wild
Which
West.
I love.
Actually, he's got some big TV thing in the works, I believe.
I know. He deserves awesome? It. He deserves it.
But anyway, big thank you to him because he played our promo. It was just off
and
the sweet
we
of
ended up getting millions from it.
Yeah.
Not really.
No. Big thank you for
check him out. It's
to
good.
Him and check him out.
Especially if you
him.
Like gangsters
and
history.
I will. Little warning, doesn't bother me, but it might bother some. He does like the F-bomb, but it's totally cool.
It's those kids today.
I know.
They use it like a comma, I tell ya.
But it's worth a listen. Anyway, give it a shot, Mr. Your Circumstances. So anyway, what do you have for us today,
well,
my good friend Cam?
Well, thanks, my fellow good friend Jen. I have a case that takes us all the way up to Alaska.
Alaska?
Alaska.
Alaska?
I don't think we've done Alaska, have we? I don't think we've
you've done,
done
everybody.
That's not what I meant.
Oh.
I don't think we've done a case in Alaska. Have we?
No, I do not believe we have.
Okay. That's what I meant.
Because honestly, the only one I know is, I can't think
Robert
of his name.
Robert Hansen.
Robert Hansen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Funny that you should mention that
mm-hmm.
because one of the big authors that wrote a book on him also wrote this book.
Well.
Looky there. Okay. So he
wow,
wrote a book on Robert
that's
Hansen.
Cosmic.
This is another story that takes place up in Alaska, and the name of the book is What Happened in Craig, and the author's name is Leland E. Hale, H-A-L-E. Awesome. So I got some of my stuff from there. I got some stuff from TV show, and I got some stuff from online, and just put it all together is what I did.
And made a great big story.
I did. That's not, well, yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear about it.
All right, Jen, today we are headed to Craig, Alaska, mm-hmm. to talk about what is the worst mass murder in Alaska's history.
Ooh.
Now, Craig is a beautiful fishing town on the coast of Alaska. It's located about 1,000 miles south of Anchorage. I want to go to Alaska so bad, I can't stand it. The town itself is really small. It's got a population of around 1,000 people, but this little community,
mostly men, I'm sure,
explodes during fishing season.
Oh,
okay, the summer fishing season up there. Craig, Alaska was a port in which the fisher people, you like how I put that? Because, you know, women can be there too. Fisher people would deliver their fish, their big hauls, to be processed. And during this time, with lots of people coming and going, the fishing season would take place over the summer months. And this case is going to take us to Labor Day weekend of this fishing season.
Okay. So fishing season's basically summer.
Yeah, it's a summer month. The docks in Craig are full of people turning in their last big catch. There's fishing boats all over the place. And you know fishing boats. They're not exactly pretty boats. No offense, people out there. But they're nice, sturdy, working vessels.
Well,
you know, I like...
utilitarian.
Yeah, I like to say they're like the working class of the boat world, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're the little trucks that could.
Mm-hmm. Like our podcast.
Yeah,
little
exactly.
Little podcast that could.
That's exactly right, girl.
Or tries.
So, nothing fancy about them. So on September 5th, 1982, when a fancy fishing boat named the Investor is parked in the docks, it catches a lot of attention. It's not your ordinary working boat. This was a 58-foot long fishing vessel with all the bells and whistles, and it would cost today over $800,000.
Oh, wow.
It stood out from all the others. I mean, it caught everybody's eye. High-tech, state-of-the-art fishing boat. This beautiful boat belonged to a man named Mark Colehurst. Mark Colehurst was from Blaine, Washington. And this guy did something that's not only brave, but I guess it could be a little bit dangerous, too. You see, Mark liked to take his entire family along on his fishing summers as he worked the Alaskan waterways. Mark was age 28, and he was married to Irene, who was also 28. Now, Irene was pregnant with their third child. The couple were high school sweethearts, and after they married, Irene would join his fishing business. The young couple already had two children, a 5-year-old little girl named Kimberly and a boy named John, who is just 4 years old. Those that fish together stay together, Jen.
I know. Hey, it's a big family vacay.
Could you imagine?
That would be hell.
Stuck on a boat with your family? You talked about your 1 week vacation.
Hell.
Ooh.
Utter hell.
And stressful. Like, this is stressful.
And dangerous.
That's what
so I'm to have like a small kid and
don't pet the
do
sharks.
This.
Mark had started fishing when he was just 16 years old, and he worked many boats and immediately started working his way to bigger and better boats. Mark was very hardworking and driven. He was very determined. He wanted to make a good life for himself, for his family, and he enjoyed it. The Investor, his boat, proved that he did work hard, and he got what he wanted. He had purchased that vessel, I guess you could say, the summer prior to 1982, which is when this is right now. The fishing season had been very good to the family and Mark. He had just brought in a load of 77,000 pounds of pink salmon, which would garner them around $33,000. Not bad for a summer gig, huh?
For one day? No, that was
that was his load. So that would be, you'd go out, ship for your however many days and then come back.
Wow.
That's a lot.
But let's talk about the resources that he's taken from the ocean.
Hey, man, it was 1982. We didn't know about resources
we
yet.
We didn't know that. No, that's amazing.
Right?
But it's totally dangerous work.
Which takes me to my next point, Jen.
Oh,
thank
there you go.
The fishing business can be grueling and a very unforgiving job. I watched Deadliest Catch.
I've watched it a couple
times. That's crazy. Like, it is super dangerous.
It is.
And boring. You work your butt off for an amount of time, right? And then you kind of just wait. You wait for the fish to come. Aboard the Investor, you would find 4 deckhands that the Colehurst had employed. These were Chris Heyman, age 18, and Dean Moore,
Jerome Keown and Michael Stewart, all 19 years old.
Oh, geez.
They were babies. I mean, these guys are young. These young men were all in their late teens, so fishing for them gave them a decent amount of money. They were fit. They were strong. And, you know, they were saving up for college and, you know, just young. They could get away.
Well, it's an adventure, right?
Yeah.
Some people travel.
September 5th was the day. The docks were buzzing with people. And by buzzing, I mean lots of people running around, celebrating. They had just ended the fishing season, so they were getting ready to pack it in and go home to their families if they had them. Or a lot of these fisher people would come up from the state of Washington and fish to Alaska because the waters were better. And it was kind of, you know, just what they did during the summer. It was. The Colehurst were also celebrating, as that day, September 5th, was Mark's 28th birthday.
Oh, geez.
The family was heading to a local restaurant to enjoy a celebratory dinner for Mark. And there was lots of things to be thankful for. The season was great. They were pregnant with the third baby. You know, they were getting ready to wrap it up and go home.
That's amazing. I can't imagine being 28 years old, having three kids.
I can't imagine being pregnant on a boat stuck for the summer.
Like, he, at 28, he had a business that was obviously doing well. And at 28, I was still writing checks at a bar.
Yeah, I got... Is that $4?
Bad checks at a bar, or asking them, please, can you hold it until next Thursday? Yeah.
Oh, Lord, girl. As they finished their dinner, which was around 9:30 that evening, they headed back to their boat, the Investor, and they climbed aboard, you know, for the night. They were packing it in. Next to the Investor was a boat named the Libby 8. It was a fishing vessel owned and operated by Larry Demert Jr. It was around 2 a.m. that Larry is awoken from a sleep. He hears something strange outside, and he describes it as sort of like a popping noise. So he's half asleep, probably half in the bag, too, because they were all partying. And so he kind of moseys over to the porthole next to his bed, and he opens it up, and he looks out. Larry thinks he can see a person moving about on the deck of the Investor, but he can't be sure. He's really exhausted. He's, you know, half asleep, half awake. Maybe he imagined it. He wasn't a dead sleep, you know, so he woke up. So he kind of sits there for a second. He's kind of positive that it's nothing. So he rolls over and goes back to sleep. The next morning, the town wakes up to a very heavy fog, which I love. You know, that coastal fog? I love that. I do. Mm-hmm. Just fog makes me so happy, like rain. As the people were all on the docks, they're starting to mill about, get their boats ready for the day. They're getting ready to dock their boats for the winter, right, and all that stuff. So they're up early doing some things around the dock. As the people were getting up and about starting their day, they noticed that the Investor had moved away from the dock. It wasn't moored there as it was the night before. It's not by the Libby 8. They could see the boat, and actually it just kind of seemed to be floating out there aimlessly, as if it's not manned by anybody. Town people continued to observe it throughout the day, and that was September 6th. Never really, you know, venturing out there to check on it, just thinking that maybe they're hanging out or whatever. So now it's September 7th, the very next day. 24 hours have passed, and still that boat seems to just be out there floating around. They haven't seen anybody move around on the boat. Nothing's going on. I think they're starting to get a little bit weirded out, a little bit curious as to what's going on out there. People are wandering about on the dock, and they're starting to debate, hey, you know, should we go out there? Should we see what's going on? They're talking about it. The boat's been out there now for over 24 hours floating with no signs of anybody actually on the boat. Nobody's come to the deck. Nobody's waved, anything like that. All of a sudden, a giant explosion bursts through the air. The Investor is engulfed totally in flames.
Ugh. And the family's still in?
They don't know yet because they haven't seen anything. And it just seems like nobody's out there. Locals rush out to the boat and they try to help put out the fire or attempt to. They were hoping that if anybody was in there, they could rescue them. But the closer they got to it, they knew that that was going to be impossible. The heat from the flames was way too intense. They couldn't get anywhere close to the boat. There was nothing that they could do but stand there and watch it and just wait. It would take hours for the fire to finally be extinguished. And when it was out, the vessel was towed into shore as authorities wanted some answers. The Investor was totally gone. It was totally burnt up and it looked terrible. It didn't even look like a boat, actually. Didn't really look like anything. It was just this mass of fried metal and unrecognizable. There was a little part of the boat. I believe it was the front. I don't know what that's called. Stern, bow. I don't know. But that portion had sprinklers, so you could still see that part of it, but everything else, it didn't even look like a boat. As investigators dig in, their worst fears would soon be realized. Police recover four bodies, including a small child, from the boat. It's become apparent to police that the Colehurst family, along with the crew hands, have all perished in this unusual, tragic accident. Perhaps it was an electrical explosion or a gas leak, but one thing was for sure, and that was that this beautiful young family and handsome young men were all taken away from those that loved them. Maybe this was just an unfortunate accident. That's what police are believing. That's what they're going with. That is, until one small detail changed everything and would make this accident so much worse. While the bodies were burnt beyond recognition, one thing was not erased by the flames. The bodies had bullet holes.
Ooh.
These people were murdered before being set on fire.
That's horrible.
I know, it's awful, right? With this shocking twist, authorities now can clearly see evidence of arson. The fire was intentionally set and was started using white gas or leaded gas. White gas is different than regular gas because it doesn't have as many impurities, as many materials in it, and that makes it burn much faster and much hotter. Gets like, rid of everything much faster.
So we're talking like gasoline, or is it like gas that goes through your house? What kind of gas? Like,
no, I believe it's gas. It's a form of gasoline.
Okay.
Police enter the boat to continue to look for more bodies, as they know that there have to be more on the vessel because they had those young crew hands and, you know, they're missing some. The boat is so full of ash and debris that they have to be careful collecting evidence as they enter it. It's kind of an unusual setting, you know. I'm sure they have boat fires, but because it was burned so badly, everything was ash, right? So it was hard to collect. It wasn't like stuff just jumped out. So the investigators decide that they need to do something to make sure they don't miss anything. So they get sort of like a sifter, like a screen with the prospectors. I don't know what the proper name for that would be, but they're going to sift through every single thing looking for these bodies, right?
Well, that's archaeology.
Yeah. I don't know what those are called, though.
Sifters, I would think.
Okay.
Or sieves.
Okay. I don't know.
Sieves. Colander.
I put that. I said kind of like a colander or a prospector's tool.
Yeah.
I wrote that in there.
A shifting.
Because I don't know what it's called, and I should have looked it up, but I didn't. Since the boat is pretty much just ashes now, it was important to collect something from the scene. Days went by going through all of the debris and ashes, and some of the things they would find were bone fragments and teeth. And sadly, the four bodies would be the only four bodies they would collect. Those other bodies were burnt beyond recognition. Can you imagine?
They must have been right where the gas exploded.
The bodies, along with the teeth and bones, were all sent to the coroner, where it was determined the bullet holes were caused from a .22 caliber gun. The four bodies were identified as Mark and Irene Colehurst, their daughter Kimberly, and deckhand Michael Stewart. What couldn't be determined was why or who would have or could have done this to them. The community of Craig is in shock and distraught. You know, it's hard to believe that this would ever happen. And everybody knew each other. They all had the same job. They all were fisher people, right? So they, it was.
Well, when something like that happens in your community, whether you like the people or not, you all tend to come together. And
as police continue to work the scene, they determine that they believe that the boat was moved. So it was actually driven by the killer, it would seem, to a nearby island called Fish Egg Island, which I love that name. That's located about a mile from Craig. So you could actually see the boat from Craig, but it was closer to that area. Now, here's the interesting thing. The police also believed that the killer had believed, I guess, or hoped, that the boat would fill, the engine cooling system area part of the boat would fill up with water
and
the boat would sink. Well, guess what? It didn't. That's why it stood out there and, you know, floated about. So the killer would return, set it on fire. Rumors started to fly. Police are continuing to work on finding answers. They're kind of at a loss. As everything, it takes a while for all this to come out. The thought was brought up that maybe Mark, you know, he had had such a good fishing season that maybe he had left a large amount of cash on the boat. And somebody that they knew and trusted knew that, and they climbed aboard the boat, shot all those people, and took the money. I mean, that was what they were first going with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So police look into that, and they find that actually Mark never would take cash payments. He didn't believe in that, which is pretty smart, right? So he would have that money put right into his account. So he didn't carry much money, cash money, with him at all. Police pretty much ruled that theory, that idea out about the money. They begin interviewing some people, and they stumble upon two people who have a little information. They said that they were on the dock that morning, you know, packing up their boat, when they noticed all of these flames start shooting out of the investors' windows, the boat's windows. Bruce Anderson and Jan Kittleson, the couple, said that they jump in their boat and they head into the direction of the investor. You know, they're hoping nobody's aboard the boat, but if they are, that they can maybe get there and help them in some way. While they're making their way out to the vessel, they claim that they see a gray motor-powered skiff heading toward them. So away from the fire, toward them, right? A skiff is one of those smaller boats with the opening. See, I knew you'd know what it was. I had to look it up. I didn't know what it was.
Like, but it's a dinghy. Good that you said it for our other folks. That
it is. So it's kind of like, sort of like a John boat, kind of flat bottom, right? Open. Driving the skiff was a young white man believed to be in his late teens or early 20s. He had light brown hair. He was wearing sunglasses and a baseball hat. And this is so creepy. It just gives me the heebie-jeebies. Jan states that she yelled to the man in the skiff asking if anyone was on the boat. And the man answered her, "Yeah, there is." And he kept going, continued past them as they were going to the investor trying to help them. The couple at first thought that he was obviously going to go, or I guess not obviously, they were hoping he was going to go to shore and get help.
Right.
That was not the case.
Well, that's like most human.
Yeah, normal people. He would be the killer, you see. Two more witnesses come forward and they tell police that a man fitting that same description came to the dock in a skiff. And in fact, the boat, it's still there. Police raced to the boat hoping to find some evidence, but it had begun raining and it was raining really hard, so it made it virtually impossible to collect any evidence that may have been there before. It was mostly washed away. They tried, but they weren't able to collect any fingerprints or evidence. Days began passing by. The town, the community, they're, you know, all starting to thin out, go back to their winter homes, go back to the state of Washington or wherever they came from. And, you know, Craig is starting to dwindled down to its regular year-round population, minus the summer. Police were scared that perhaps this killer would be among those that would leave, so they knew that time was of the essence, that they had to get on this and find this guy before he escaped and, you know, went about his life. At this same time, a local man named Jerry Mackey goes to grab a beer at a bar in town. As he cozies up to the bar, he notices a man sitting there that fits the description the police had been giving out, the one of the man that was in the skiff the day that the investor exploded. Jerry knows that he needs to call police, so he kind of slithers away, makes his way back to the payphone, and he calls police. Police become very excited, and they want to know if this is the guy. On the way to the bar, they stop and pick up Bruce and Jan. They want that couple to actually see this guy in person and identify him as the man that they saw that day on the boat. The couple goes to the bar, and they do their little secret walk-by of the stranger. They come outside and they tell police, nope, that's not the same guy. Police are not happy. They don't like that information. So they decide to pull out the young man and, you know, ask him a few questions. The man would turn out to be a 24-year-old from the state of Washington named John Peel. Peel informs investigators that he was a deckhand on the Libby 8, that same boat that was moored next to the investor on the night of September 5th. And was, in fact, on that boat that night. Peel would go on to say that he knew Mark, as he dated Mark's sister Lisa several years prior. But that's not all, Jen. Never is it? He also worked for Mark on a different boat, a boat that Mark had worked on earlier. And, you know, since then, they'd kind of lost touch, the two of them speaking and stuff. He didn't talk to Lisa anymore either. So all of this comes together and puts John Peel as possible suspect number one. But without much to go on, without anything permanent, without anything concrete, they have to let him go. Police are now going to focus in on him. Authorities decide to go back to Larry Demmert. Now, he's the captain of the Libby 8 boat. They want to talk to him once again. Larry tells police that he has known John virtually all of his life and that John was a really good worker. And, you know, he had prior experience in the fishing industry. So Larry hired him as a crew hand on the Libby 8. Now, Larry can't say for sure if John was on the Libby 8 that very night of September 5th. Can't seem to remember. he hadn't seen John Peel for several days after that. Police kind of get a weird vibe from Larry. Mm-hmm. They say he's kind of acting strange, maybe not telling the whole truth.
You don't say.
True. 12 days after the murders, the town held a memorial for all 8 of the victims. The others on the boat, Chris Heyman, Jerome Keome, Dean Moon, and young John had not yet been identified as being on the boat, but their families were positive that they were, and soon evidence would prove it. The coroner was working very hard using dental records to try to identify the others, and soon he is able to positively say that Chris Heyman and Jerome Keome were on the boat. Dean Moon and 4-year-old John had not yet been accounted for on the vessel. That would just, the amount of heat. I mean, when you get cremated,
they didn't find the teeth?
No, they did find the teeth. That's how they did that. You're not listening.
No, but you said their body, didn't you just say that they weren't identified?
The bones fragments and the teeth that they found, they have linked them to 2, but not the other 2. So the other 2 are still, they have no proof that they were on there.
Right. That's what I meant.
Yeah. Not yet. Okay. Somebody else finds something later, but you'll see. September 1983 comes, marking a full year that has passed since the murders of 8 people, and still police have no answers. At a loss, they go back and decide to re-interview all those they've spoken to earlier, hoping that maybe somebody will shed some new light on the case. Having felt that Larry Demert might not be telling all that he knows, investigators start with him. And guess what? Wouldn't you know it? Larry has some new information that he didn't share earlier.
No way.
I know you're shocked. I know.
Was he holding back on us?
He was. Larry says that on September 5th, he was coming home from his girlfriend's house. As he was approaching the Libby 8, his boat, he notices that there is a party of sorts on the Investor, the one that was docked next to his boat.
Mark's boat.
As he was watching, he saw John Peel leave the Libby 8 and climb aboard the Investor. He also says, and he neglected to say this earlier, that John did not spend the night on the Libby 8. Earlier, remember, he said he couldn't be sure if he did or not. And that's not all, Jen. Larry informs police that he had guns on his boat. It was a .22 single-shot rifle and a .22 revolver. And that night, they went missing.
No way.
Larry,
no way.
Way.
Larry, what a coincidence.
Quink-dink. Larry then says, a few days later, they reappeared. Different location, different spot on his boat, but they came back.
Do you think they have a ghost?
I do. A ghost that can carry guns around mysteriously. Police interview another crew member of the Libby 8. Now, this is a man by the name of Brian Palinkas. Brian tells police that John Peel had brought a few of the crew members over to the Libby 8 that night from the Investor, and that Peel had sold marijuana to Jerome Keown and Dean Moon. Police bring John Peel back in, and he admits that he did sell them marijuana. And, well, yes, he did work for Mark. And, yes, he was fired because he liked a little bit of the devil's lettuce too much and often would like it on the job, which
can't be safe.
cannot be safe with those giant ton anchors and the fishing gear and all
over.
That stuff.
No, that's just dumb.
So Mark got very angry, got very irate, obviously, and fired him. And he was so upset that he forbid him to ever even step foot back on the boat, which is kind of a big deal because as a friend, they were friends prior.
And he was doing it in front of his family, too.
So the relationship turned out to be very toxic. Police believe that John Peel has the motive, but they need something stronger. They test the gun that had went missing and then reappeared, you know, the gun that Larry owned.
Mm-hmm. The ghost.
And the findings came back inconclusive. With nothing more than deep suspicions, the police have to let John Peel go. Do you think John Peel did it?
I don't know.
Investigators put together a sketch of the man that was seen that day on the skiff and circulate it to all of the media and the townspeople, the community. A man comes into the station and tells police that he saw that man pull into the dock that September day. They pull out some photos and they ask the man to identify the man that he believes he saw, or is it any of these guys? And points to none other than John Peel. So we have 3 witnesses, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
On September 10th, 1984, 2 years after the murders, police feel that they have enough evidence against John Peel. Peel is arrested and charged with 8 counts of murder. In January 1985, Peel arrives to court for his arraignment. Now, while this is kind of funny, it's not. due to the publicity of the case, his attorney didn't want his face seen. Mm-hmm. So he forced him to wear a ski mask to his arraignment. And when I say a ski mask, I don't mean it was like the colored sweaters from the 80s. So it's like red with like the flowers around the mm-hmm. neck, like a real old fashioned ski mask.
Right.
They didn't want the jurors to be, you know, to see him at his arraignment and
prejudice.
Yes. Prosecutors have a plan. They're going to claim that John Peel was angry that he was fired from Mark and seeking revenge. The defense, however, is going to claim that John was never mad. And if he were mad, he wouldn't kill 8 people just because he couldn't work for Mark. He was a young kid. I mean, mm-hmm. he could still go about his life. It was fine. The key witness would turn out to be John's former employee, Larry Demmert. You know, the captain of the Libby 8.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? Mr. Demmert happened to remember just a few more details not previously shared. He would share these on the stand.
He probably needs to start doing those like memory games because they're just coming in bits and pieces.
Right. Larry claimed that along with those pops he heard that night, he also heard a woman scream. He claims he looked out the porthole and this time he saw John Peel on the dock of the Investor and John Peel had a rifle.
You would think he would remember that.
Now, remember before he said he saw a figure,
mm-hmm.
right? He said he saw one, but that's it. Just a right. shadowy little figure. And now that figure
I think
is
I would
fact
remember
John Peel.
That if I saw somebody with a gun and hearing a pop and then hearing a woman scream, I don't think that would ever get out of my memory.
I would say that too. And then this is a very important part.
I'm thinking he's kind of hiding something.
Would lead you back to that. He also
mm-hmm.
shared on the stand that this frightened him so badly that he locked himself in his stateroom. He locked himself on the Libby 8 because he was scared that whatever was going on
would happen to him.
Right? I don't think you would forget that you locked the door because you were scared.
No. I was so scared that I locked myself in, but I totally forgot about it. I still remember being 6 and my brother jumping out from under the bed. I mean, it's scary. You remember that stuff.
You know where you are. The defense saw their chance when Larry mentioned his casual use of Valium. When pushed.
Valium, the drug?
Yes.
Not like the turning up,
no.
pump up the Valium?
No.
He was a casual Valium user.
When okay. pushed, Larry admitted he was, in fact, addicted to Valium. And he used it instead of alcohol at certain times because he didn't want to do alcohol so much. So he would alternate between the two.
Okay.
And when he was on Valium, he would not drink alcohol.
Well, that's a plus.
However, he swears, because he's on the stand, that he is sober at the time of his testimony on the stand.
If he was not sober, would that take him out of the running with his testimony?
Yeah.
Testimony being null and void?
And that's the whole point. They're trying to prove that he's not
stable.
Could an addict be trusted to say what he saw that night if he was on drugs? Like, did maybe those drugs interfere with that? And did
Correct.
He not actually see anything and whatever? The defense continued to call witness after witness, and each one was fuzzy on some details. Some of them would have part of it, some of them wouldn't, and none of it would come together to make a good, cohesive, strong case. The case, with no witnesses and no strong evidence, is going to be hard to prove. And
right.
they knew that, right? It's now July 1986. It's almost been 4 years. And as hard as they tried, the jury could not reach a decision. It became a hung jury. The families are devastated, but the state does not give up the fight yet. So they really didn't have anything.
No. They had an addict's testimony, and yeah.
That's it. In 1988, the state takes another shot at John Peel. They bring him back to trial, and now they have 2 new star witnesses. These 2 men are brothers, and they claim that they went fishing with John Peel up in Zodiac, Alaska. And during that fishing expedition, Peel admitted to them that he was the one who slaughtered those 8 people September 5th, 1982.
Wow.
Now, as before, the defense goes after credibility with these mm-hmm. witnesses. And they learned just a little secret, little fact about one of those witnesses that are up there on that stage, one of the brothers. They learned that Sam Wasco was, he would be testifying against John Peel. And in doing so, he would be allowed to plead a misdemeanor in another case. So in exchange for his testimony,
mm-hmm.
we're going to let you go down. You know, we're going to lessen your
yeah,
issues,
charge, right?
Right. little quid pro quo, Clarice.
Exactly.
Right?
A lot of people do that.
So that makes him not, that's not reliable. Like, you can't, after that all came out, the prosecution would have a tough time coming back and looking credible after they paid somebody, essentially, to say what they wanted to say.
Right.
After 3 months of testimony, the jury would deliberate for 4 days. Due to the lack of evidence, the jury comes back and finds John Peel not guilty.
Wow.
Peel filed a wrongful prosecution suit against the state of Alaska to get his legal fees paid for, and he was awarded a settlement of
$900,000.
$900,000? $900,000, almost a million, almost $1 million. Since he was tried and found not guilty, we all know what that means. This is the end of taking John Peel to trial.
Right.
He can't be ever tried again for this crime. But it's not the end of the story, Jen. In November 2016, Lisa and Lori, Mark's sisters, they want to confront him. They want to talk to John Peel.
Right.
So they set up a meeting with him face to face, and they just ask him,
Point blank,
think you know something. Peel flatly denies that he was ever the killer of these 8 people. And he says he has no idea who could have done it, who would have done this horrible crime. So at this point, Lori's, I think she still thinks that he did it. Lisa, however, says she's not so sure anymore, but she knows that he knows more than he's saying. The case, because it was tried, is now considered closed. So
they believe that he did it, maybe?
Pretty much everybody believes he did it, but they don't have any evidence to back it up.
Wow.
So unless he comes forward and admits it, or somebody comes forward with some shocking new information.
Deathbed confession.
It's closed. It's considered a closed case.
Well, I wonder if he had hired somebody.
Here's the thing. Let's talk about this. So it seems really weird, but he's a young kid, 24 when this first started, I guess. So how would you take out 8 people, right? So, and would you do that for money? Would you do that because you were angry? You didn't get anything out of it. I mean, in the end, he got $900,000 from the state, but...
But he
years
was probably
later.
Hoping that he wouldn't have. I mean, if you would do it, you wouldn't say, well, maybe I can be wrongly accused and sue the state.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So,
unless he was so angry, but it's not worth it. I mean,
potheads are kind of lazy. Let's be honest.
They are.
You know what I mean? I don't see that as the motive. And so, like, there's a couple different ways. If Larry says he woke up around 2 o'clock in the morning. So that's, you know, the family had young kids and they got done eating and went back to the boat at around 9:30. So from 9:30 to 2, what was taking place? Larry says he was coming home from his girlfriend's house around 10:30 and noticed a party going on. So was the party the deckhands? Did the killer get on the boat and wait and shoot,
but you would think if
shoot
there was
them as they got on?
Was the party loud because they have kids? So
I don't know.
If when my kids were young, I'll be damned if somebody, if I finally got them to bed and somebody was having a party where they could, I'm assuming if he saw it, it was a party. It wouldn't just be a bunch of people just sitting around drinking.
Or talking. Quietly.
Right.
I think the consensus is that he did it, but.
There's just not a lot of.
You can't. I mean.
I don't know. Maybe he hired some. I don't.
But then why would you do that?
Why
you
wouldn't they come forward? Yeah.
You don't get anything for that. And also, how brazen of him to come on the boat, and the witness, Jan was her name, asked if anybody was on the boat. Yep. Yeah, sure is, or whatever. Yeah, there is. That's what he said. Yeah, there is. If he just set them on fire and it exploded, you know what I'm saying? Like, how bold, how brazen to be like, he had sunglasses on, but that was it, and a hat. You know what I mean? So it's not like it's dead of night.
And what time was that?
That was the next day, the second day. So it was the 7th. When it exploded that morning.
But when the boat was coming back, what time was it? Morning?
Yeah, it was morning time.
I don't know. There's no motive.
Either.
That's always what kills me is when people do that. Or they haven't.
A
don't
solid
know
motive, yeah.
The motive. There had to have been some sort of argument. Or maybe this guy's just a sociopath.
Yep. Or maybe it's a stranger that really did get on there. I don't know. But to have it like float out there and think it's going to sink and you're sticking around watching and it doesn't. So then you've got to go out there and set it on fire and how fast it burnt that. Oh, I don't think. Did I say? I think I must have erased that. The one crew hand later, a pathologist, did I say that? Had discovered a jawbone belonging to him. So all of them were accounted for and placed on the boat, except they never found a single thing from the little boy. Nothing. And I guess because he was so little, it just.
How old was he again?
4. I just think it was so...
They're all cartilage by then anyway.
Yeah. So anyway.
That's so awful.
That's my case, Jen.
Wow.
So check out the book. I got information from that fella who wrote it. His name is Leland E. Hale, H-A-L-E, and it's What Happened in Craig. And he also wrote the Robert Hansen book, Butcher Baker.
Nightmare Maker.
Something. Is that it? Is that,
I don't know.
It's something like that. Yeah.
That's wow, it. That's interesting.
Yep.
Very good. Well, thank you.
Thanks. Sure. No problem. All right. You
enjoyed it.
Tell the good people where they can find it.
Well, first of all, I want to say that earlier this week, I did a short little interview with Ken. He has put us in a Strange Society network, or he is the leader of our Strange Society network that we are now in.
Are we going to go to outer space and see aliens? I would love
to. Well, we are in there with our friends from Promote Horror with Christopher ZC. He does ZZ Emporium for B-movies. He reviews them. Mystery Loves Garlic Bread.
Oh, yeah.
Crash Place, UFO Chronicles, and Where the Scary Things Are. Harrison Smith, he's a director of movies.
I like the title of that, Where the Scary Things.
And we are in there, too. But we did a great big roundtable. I wasn't able to make the whole thing with everybody, but Ken and I spoke separately. He's putting it all together, and it's going to air sometime soon. I will post links whenever it comes up, and you can hear me blather and bore you to death for about 5 or 6 minutes.
True.
And we're talking about the podcast, and we're talking about everybody else's podcast.
Oh, that's
very
good.
Interesting, nice group of folks. So, like I said, I will let you know when that happens.
Yay.
But otherwise, you can find us on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us through the address ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. And you can listen to us on our blog that I actually did get it updated.
Look Woo-hoo! At you.
But by the time this runs, it probably will not be updated. But our blog is www.ourtruecrimepodcast.com. I think that's it. Is that it?
I do believe probably so.
Oh, and one more thing. Please leave us more reviews.
Positive.
We love them. Positive reviews.
Hey,
we actually just got
whatever.
A bad, or it was actually 6 months ago. We just found it on Stitcher, but they gave us a bad review because we were complaining about our bad reviews. So
we're just going to continue. So we're going to stay tuned to Our True Crime Podcast, Bad Reviews. It's a second version of our podcast in which we're just going to talk about our bad reviews, all for you.
But anyway,
you
they
little
said,
angel reviewer. Just kidding.
Isley's mom said that she didn't understand why we can complain about bad reviews. Well, here's the deal, or at least my point of view. We are not allowed to comment back to reviews, and this is our only voice. So
true dat.
That's what we do. We understand if you have a problem with us, come to us. We'll take you seriously. But when you leave a bad review just because you don't have enough things to do, then we're going to say something on air. Anyway, that's all I have to say. What about you?
I concur.
All right.
Right.
So that's it.
Okay. Oh, remember, lock your doors.
Keep passing by those open windows.
Oh, bye-bye.
Love ya.
Bye. Located about 1,000 miles south of Anchorage, I would say.
You want to say 1,000?
I do want to say that again because I said it wrong.
1,000 miles.
I would walk 1,000 miles.
That reminds me of my boo.
Who's your boo?
Dave Tennant.
Oh,
he did a little video with that 500 mile song.
Oh, he did? Oh, yeah. He's got a new TV show out too. I saw it yesterday. You know which one I'm talking about?
Is it The Criminal?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know. It was one of
Well, it was one episode of Criminal. Where he played like a doctor?
No. Mm-mm. No, I think it's the whole series. And I can't.
Well, this was a whole series, but he was only in one episode.
No, I think he's the head of the guy. I don't know. I'll check it out.
He's the head of a guy?
He's the head guy in the show. No. I don't know.
Good Omens, by the way?
No, I tried to watch it. I didn't watch it. I didn't watch Carnival Row either. I couldn't get into that.
Carnival Row. What about American Horror Story?
I did start that one. Not the new one. The other one that you told me about.
Oh, and I found the new one is on Hulu.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Good thing I paid $44 for Hulu 1 month. Thank you, my dear son.
And by the way, the cutie patootie that's in the Apocalypse one is also in the newest one.
Oh, okay, good.
He's cute. He's got weird, I think he's British. He's got weird features, but they like work for him.
Mm.
I think he plays a homosexual. Mm. But I don't know. It could just be the 80s.
Yeah, it's,
I don't know.
Flipped collar. Who knows? Yeah.
All right.
Do you know how many times you have to say boat and come up with different words? Vessel, ship. Boat. It's not really a ship, though, because it's a fishing boat. So it's more of a boat. It's just, you know what I mean? Like, and then what happens?
Did you get your thesaurus out?
No. I just kept trying to think of other things, ways to say it. And then I had to think of a million ways to say explosion. But we'll get to that.
Foreshadowing right there.
Foreshadowing.
And seasickness?
Storms?
Mm. The whole thing. It's just a big, I thought camping was bad. No.
Giant nope.
No. This is like the very, this was like if I would die and go to hell,
this
that
is your
would
hell.
Be my vacation in hell.
With all the people that you couldn't stand on the boat and you have to work together.
And my family. Yeah.
Woohoo. Woo wee.
Mm-hmm. Wow. While the entire fourth grade plays the recorder.
At the same time. Yeah. Oh, that's so true.
Hot cross buns.
I can still play that on my saxophone.
Well, good for you.
You're welcome. That's I play Mary Had a Little Lamb too. Right. Anyway, cut that out, Nico.
Or put it at the end. Whatever.
Jinx! We're on fire today.
I know.
The fishing business.
The business.
The business to fishing. The fishing business. Sorry. God, I can't even say that right now. Aboard the Investor, you would also find four deckhands that the Colehurst had employed.
Deckhands?
Deckhands. Deck.
Okay.
I'm telling you, got all kinds of words in here with the new fishing stuff that I didn't even know
what
was.
At first I thought you said deckens. Deckens?
Yeah, deckens.
Yeah.
No.
I'm like, what the fuck's a deckin?
I'm going to do that whole paragraph again.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
Sorry, Nico.
No, it's okay.
Kind of disappointing that they don't have, like, funnier names.
No, they don't. That's it. Those are all the only boats we're going to get to know, too. Sorry, Jen.
Oh, I mean,
it's okay.
My uncle's boat was CEO, SEAO.
Oh, CEO. Oh, that's good.
Or SE.
And yeah. Your brother's was?
Cirrhosis of the River.
That one makes me laugh. Sorry.
Porthole. Sorry.
I hate you.
It just struck me as funny. I don't know.
It's okay. All of a sudden, a giant explosion. Sorry. God.
I something in my throat. What we're going to do for Halloween.
Pretty not smart.
It's me. I'm pretty not smart.
That's what I said.
No, I said I'm pretty not smart.
I know. That's what I said.
Bad grammar.
To a nearby island called Fish Egg Island, which I love that name. That's located about a mile from Craig. But
I think they'd just call it Row. And you could row, row, row your boat.
Two more.
Two more.
Hell, Jen. It's me. It's the little podcast that could or tried. Whatever.
If it can't be done half-assed, we're not going to do it at all.
It's the podcast with the C-minus. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You're not flunking. You're not the smartest, but you're not the dumbest.
Let's do. Okay, I'm sorry, but Jerome Keom?
Jerome Keom. Yep. Jerome Keom. Now, see, now you put that in my head. I'm going to mess it up. You watch.
Well, now it's like Tony.
Baloney?
No, Tony.
Nardoni.
Nardoni.
I know.
Jerome Balome.
Keom.
Keom. My name is Jerome Keom. And here's my friend.
You think about
Tony
I was
Nardoni.
Like with the students that I have with the names. And I'm like, doesn't that ever. Doesn't, come on. You know what I mean? Like, come on, put it together. Say it out loud a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
Just like so many names in the world. Whatever. Okay, here we go.
Maybe the mom was a poet.
And she didn't know it.
Well, obviously she did with Jerome Keom.
Jerome Keom.
Unless it's pronounced somehow differently.
It's not. Okay. I checked. And these names, I was thinking of this. I was like, thank God all these names are pretty normal. Like, mm-hmm. It's not, right? I was happy about that.
I hope they get them for contempt.
You're going to die. You're gonna shit. I think Nico took that out of the last one, which I thought was funny.
That's
Fast Times at Richmond High.
I know, I love that.
He's going shit. He's gonna,
my brother's gonna kill us. My brother's gonna shit.
I can.
What's he gonna do?
I speak in movie quotes all the. You know, like the big thing now is because of Seven and like my crime class. Because I'll bring boxes in there and paper bags of stuff for them to look at or whatever, and they'll be like, "What's in the box?" And they don't even get it. I go, what's in the box?
And that's like my favorite. We do that all the time.
Well, and then they're all like, what? I go, it's movie 7. Brad Pitt, check it out. And they're like, huh? I go, it's a serial killer. And like I'm explaining. And I'm like, never mind.
It's a huge meme. I'm surprised that, oh, I'm sorry. It's not on YouTube. So
well, they probably don't know it. Or they see the meme, but they're not making whatever, you know. Okay.
Yeah.
Back to our story. Police interview another crew member of the Libby 8, a man by the name of Brian Palinkas. Brian tells...
His was the hardest name, and I said it right. Now you messed me up.
No, Palinkas. It just reminds me, because on The Good Place, they always call everybody a dinkus.
I know. Oh, God, that's funny. Okay, hold on.
It's Palinkas, Dinkus, and Jerome Carome.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to make fun of people's names.
No, don't. But
sometimes it's hard.
See, now I'm going to mess up these names because I bragged. I just got all snotty and bragged that I was doing really good with the names, and now I'm going to mess them up.
You're welcome.
It's because she's your mom.
What can I say except you're welcome?
It became a hung juror. It became a hung jury.
I was going to say, who's the hung juror over there?
The families.
Hubba, hubba. Hello? Are you there, Cam? You're on your phone. Are you there?
I'm just letting you talk.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I concur. That's all I gotta say about that.
What I say? Were you listening?
I totally was listening. If you want to leave us a bad review, you go ahead, but reach out to us, and you know we'll take you seriously. We'll listen to you. But when you're gonna leave a bad review because you have nothing else to do in your time, then that is not okay.
Very good.
Thanks. I listen, Jen. I can multitask, unlike you.
Sometimes.